720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Very honored you would spend part of your Saturday with me. Lots to do today on the show, lots of things to talk about. We're going to be a little bit later in the show talking about the Hatchimals, you know, that thing, that toy that's sort of the it toy this year. We're going to be talking about that, in particular, how one author bought several and where that brought her. Very, very interesting story. Also, we're going to be talking about some changes at Google that are really, really interesting that might mean a really big shift for them, and how the USDA is making some changes. I know that is a topic we talk about a lot on this show, and these changes are almost exactly opposite of where we thought they were going and where they said maybe they were going just a few months ago that we were talking about on the program. So we are going to keep you updated on that. But right now, we are joined by Emma Levine. She recently helped conduct a study that concluded that being visibly happy at work might have some unexpected downsides. Emma is the Assistant Professor of Behavior Science at University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. Hi, Emma. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Well, so tell us about this, because we always hear how important it is to be happy and express gratitude and all of those things, but your research suggests that maybe there's a downside to being upbeat, particularly in the workplace. Tell us about that, if you would.
Right, exactly. There's a huge literature, both in organizational behavior, but also the huge self-help literature suggesting we should seek out happiness, we should be happy, you know, doing so might increase our sales, lead us to have higher ratings of performance, make us seem attractive and likable. But we wanted to see if there are boundaries of this effect. And, you know, we actually were just thinking about, you can picture someone who just seems a little bit too happy. They're bubbly and cheerful almost all of the time. And maybe when you see that kind of person, you think something's a little off, right? There must be something that's causing this person to express happiness in a way that's not quite normal. And when you see these types of emotional expressions, you look for an explanation. And in this case, when someone's really happy like that, the explanation that people search for is that this person must be naive. They must be missing information about the world or not thinking very carefully. And so we study that judgment across six different studies and find that, yeah, very happy people, people who express happiness kind of every single day or at high magnitudes, are seen as naive. And as a result, we actually exploit them. So we act more competitively towards them in negotiations. We exploit them when we have a conflict of interest. So we're more likely to take advantage of these people.
You know, as you're saying this, I'm sitting here thinking of several examples of times where I've seen that play out, right? Perfectly nice people that work very hard, and sometimes their productivity is quite high, but nonetheless, I hear people say, oh, well, I'm a realist. You know, you hear people say, well, it's not that I'm negative, I'm just a realist, and so-and-so isn't quite that realistic. I think that's something we hear a lot. I think that's probably a really popular narrative. So what do we see around productivity? Although maybe if you are a very happy person in the workplace, your coworkers might perceive you as being naive. Does that translate into productivity?
We don't study productivity directly in our studies, but we do know from past research that, yeah, happy people do tend to be productive, or at least perceived as so. But it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? You could imagine that there's an employee who, you know, seems very cheerful, and so they do get more assignments from their boss. But in a way, that's exploitative, because I know that this person isn't going to be skeptical of why I'm assigning them more work and why I may be asking them to do overtime when other people aren't. So being happy could both have these performance boosts, and you might actually continue to be seen as intelligent and productive, but there's some level of exploitation that comes with that, because I know, you know, you're not going to be untrusting of kind of the increased workload I'm giving you.
Certainly. And so if you are one of those people at work, and I'm sure there's someone listening going, oh, man, I think that's me. You know, how do you maybe counter that a little bit, or try to help make yourself appear less naive and perhaps be a little more trusted in the workplace?
Right. So we've done lots of studies to look at that, to look at kind of what can de-bias this judgment. And because the root of the judgment is really that very happy people seem to not be seeking out negative information about the world, all you have to do to counteract this belief that you're naive is show people that you do, you know, understand the world around you. So we ran a study where basically we learned about a very happy person who experiences some misfortune. There was a fire in his neighborhood, and he either actually kind of avoids really learning or processing that tragedy, or finds out more information and he wants to learn about what happened. And when we see very happy people speaking out negative information in the world, we realize, oh, they're just kind of resilient, but they are processing the world in a deep way. We no longer judge them to be naive, and then we're less likely to exploit them. So practically, the advice, you know, would be, you know, you can be very happy, but it's important to every once in a while send very clear signals to people that, you know, I'm reading the newspaper, I understand there's tragedy in the world, or maybe even, you know, be vulnerable once in a while, express some variation in emotion, show people that there is kind of something deeper to you than this facade of happiness.
Definitely. Well, so that's the takeaway there, is to make sure that you, if you are one of those very perpetually happy people at work, make sure that you are expressing that you're aware of the downsides of issues. There is an interesting piece at the Sun Times. You can go to suntimes.com and read a little bit more about this research. Emma Levine, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right, we are going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking about some more changes to the USDA. Our friend Greg Trotter will be joining us right after the break on 720 WGN. All right, we're back on the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us today. You know, Greg Trotter from the Chicago Tribune is on this program a lot, and he's always bringing us really, really good information. And it's very fascinating to me because we have talked about the USDA several times with Greg, and it's very interesting how they have changed course a couple of times, and we think they're going one way, and they quickly go another. But that's an agency for you, I suppose. But welcome back to the program, Greg Trotter, to talk to us about something that I don't think we saw coming, because just a few months ago we were talking, Greg, about how the USDA seemed, particularly around food stamp programs, how they were going to try to get people to eat healthier and have healthier options in a lot of stores, including corner stores, not just grocery stores. But it seems like they've gone a totally different direction now. So catch us up with what's going on now.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Amy. So basically, this is a continuation of our conversation from several months ago. The USDA had this plan to increase the amount of healthy food items in all stores that receive reimbursement through the federal food stamp program. And on Thursday, they issued their final rule. And you know, I think basically it represents a huge compromise. And even the USDA Secretary Kevin Concannon, Undersecretary Kevin Concannon, said that this is the most they've ever revised any of their rules in his 8 years with the USDA. And, you know, that's in large part because of the opposition to the original proposal. So basically, the final rule does significantly increase the amount of required healthy food items in all SNAP stores. And so healthy food items being staple food items in the four categories. So you have dairy, bread, meat, and fruits and vegetables. So it does significantly increase it from the total number from 12 to 84, total number of staple food items. But, you know, it was originally proposed to be 168. So they basically halved it from their original proposal. There were a couple other things they did too, a couple of the provisions they eliminated entirely because of the opposition from businesses and politicians. One was they eliminated the provision that food with multiple ingredients could not be counted as a staple food item. So pizza, chicken pot pie, soups, all of that can still be counted as a staple food item. And lastly, another provision that they changed dramatically is there was this provision to, if your retailer has more than 15% of its food sales coming from food that's cooked or heated on premise, then you would be ineligible to participate in the food stamp program. And so that was opposed by the convenience store lobby. Obviously, they had a big problem with that. You know, they a lot of convenience stores sell food that's hooked or cooked or heated on premise. And so they changed that to make it a little bit more specific. They're still trying to close the loophole. So those were some of the changes.
So when we're saying cooked or heated on premise, we're talking about 7-Eleven nachos, more or less, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Just making sure. And so,
yeah,
as
hot dogs, pizza.
Right, right. All those kind of convenience foods. So was this originally the path that we thought we were on here? Did we originally kind of feel like this was about eliminating processed foods or having not offering reimbursement for processed foods to steer people towards more whole foods?
Yeah. And I think that's still the case. I mean, I do think that, you know, this, you know, Kevin Concannon, the USDA undersecretary, says it's still a step forward. And, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, it's still a significant change. They're increasing. So for each of the four staple food groups, it takes the variety, the number of varieties in each category from 3 to 7. So instead of 3 different varieties of dairy, for example, you know, milk, sour cream, cheese, now you have to have 7. And you have to have 3 units of each, so 3 loaves of bread. So it does significantly increase it, but you know, I mean, I think that three of the four categories have to have perishable items, so they can't all be canned goods or processed goods. So there are changes there that will, you know, I think you know, Concannon said that this is going to have the most impact in low-income communities, where, you know, a convenience store or a corner store may be the only sort of outpost of nutrition in the community.
Right. And it seemed like the opposition from businesses had a lot to do with logistics of keeping perishable foods on hand.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, this is not an issue at all for supermarkets because they likely already meet these requirements. It's definitely an issue more so for the small convenience stores and corner stores because of limited space and other constraints. You know, they don't get the same kind of economies of scale in ordering food that the large supermarkets do.
Sure.
So, and in some, you know, what I've heard from corner store owners is, okay, we can stock more fruits and vegetables, but nobody's going to buy them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like this gap also in, you know, sort of an education component in some communities that needs to happen. And some organizations in Chicago are working on that. They're partnering with corner stores, offering, you know, doing samples in the store and cooking classes and things of that nature.
And as this resistance came from businesses, I know some of it also came from lawmakers and other people in the political sphere. What about from the community? Was there a lot of pushback from the community, or was this mostly from businesses?
Yeah, I mean, I have not heard, you know, any real pushback from just random, you know, community members. It's more, definitely more from people who own and operate convenience stores, from lawmakers that represent both urban and rural communities who were concerned that, you know, if they're, you know, the stores can't comply, then they're kicked out of the food stamp program. And then basically for a lot of stores, for a lot of small stores in some neighborhoods, that means they have to close their business because, I mean, some corner stores in Chicago, that's, you know, like 80% of their business is through the federal reimbursement, you know, from the food stamp program. So if they get kicked out of the program, that means they're closing the business. And that means has this inadvertent effect of, you know, basically less access to food. So that was the concern of some lawmakers.
Sure.
And you know, so that's sort of how the USDA has sort of presented this compromise, is that, you know, they're trying to increase the access to healthy food and balance it against those concerns that some stores could be kicked out of the program.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the timeline here? I know that sometimes it seems like USDA things, unlike many other agencies, it seems like USDA things tend to go pretty quickly.
Yeah, so they filed on Thursday with the Federal Register. And then once that's published, which should be in the next couple of weeks, it goes into effect 30 days from there. And then from that point, stores have a year to comply with certain provisions and then 4 months to comply with others.
I see. So the 30-day mark, we'll put it on the books, but then they have a little more time to get it together.
Yeah. And so basically everybody will be required, all retailers will be required to to, you know, get in line basically by within a year or so.
Interesting. Well, thanks for keeping us updated. I think this is a really interesting, you know, as you said, it is a compromise, but it's one I don't think many of us saw coming as we have been talking about USDA and its related issues mm-hmm. on this program. Well, thanks so much for being with us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me, and happy holidays.
Thanks. You too. Everybody, head to ChicagoTribune.com to follow all the work that Greg Trotter is doing about this and many other topics. And be sure you follow him on social media. All right. We're going to take a little break, and we're going to get you to news and check in upstairs and all that good stuff. And when we come back, we are going to be talking about some big changes at Google, and they probably are not what you think. So we'll be talking about that when we return on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you for spending part of your Saturday afternoon with me. I'm most grateful to you for that. Still lots to do on the Wintrust Business Lunch, of course. You know, we think about the tech giants. We think about Google and Twitter and, you know, Amazon and Facebook and all those guys are just having gobs of money. And indeed, many of them do. And Google, in fact, makes so much money, they haven't really had to worry much about it and worry much about applying any kind of financial discipline to that pile of money until now. So joining us now is Max Chafkin, who is a writer at Bloomberg. Hi, Max. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, how's it going, Amy?
Good. Thanks for joining us today. So this story that you have written for Bloomberg is really, really interesting because it reminds us that there are so many facets to Google, many of which we forget about in the day to day because we're so busy just going to Google, searching our thing, and off we go. But there are so many other you know, things they're working on, labs, the kind of, you know, the big pie in the sky sort of moonshot things, as they say. But it looks like they are changing course a little bit with the business structure. So tell us about that a bit, if you would.
Yeah. So what's happening at Google, and it's really interesting. I mean, this is probably one of the strangest companies in the history of capitalism. Basically, you think of Google, you think of having all of these different services. So search, obviously, but also email. You know, they make hardware, they make a web browser, they have these kind of crazy things like the self-driving car, they have a plan to use drones to deliver packages. So all these things, like, you know, dozens of things, YouTube. And the interesting thing is that almost all of the money comes from basically a single business, which is advertising. And many of these, especially the crazier ones, are basically just these, as we say in the story, kind of really expensive hobbies. And one of the things that Google is sort of trying to figure out right now and is sort of wrestling with internally is basically how much weight to give to these new to the new stuff, to the stuff that could one day turn into a huge business. Like if the driverless car thing pans out, Google could be, you know, one of the largest automakers. And how much should it devote to the core business, which is advertising? And that's kind of a hard thing, especially at a company that kind of prides itself on being weird, or as they say in Mountain View, where the company's located, googly.
Right. And so tell us also about Alphabet, because I think there's some degree of confusion about the kind of the structure, the corporate structure there.
So, yeah, about a year and a half ago, Larry Page basically shocked everybody, both inside and outside of Google. Larry Page, who was then the CEO of Google, announcing that he was renaming the company to this thing called Alphabet. And the idea, as he kind of explained, was to sort of create something that looks a little bit like Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. So a holding company called Alphabet that he and his co-founder Sergey Brin control, with all these little subsidiaries, the largest of which is Google. Interestingly, you know, almost nobody inside of Google even knew this was coming, let alone people on the outside. And as we write in the story, the idea was both to kind of create a little bit more financial discipline to try to hold some of these moonshot things like the driverless car accountable, but also to sort of convey to investors, you know, just how good the search business was, to make it a little bit easier for the investors to see, okay, like, you know, Google basically makes about $20 billion a year, and all these other things lose, I don't know, like a couple of billion. And so that was intended to give people confidence. And it has mostly. The stock is way up over the last year and a half.
And so then take us up to the point where Project Loon starts and how that really started to, it seemed like some cracks started to show once Project Loon came into the picture.
Yeah, so Project Loon, which some folks may have heard of, it's the plan, which sounds almost insane, is to launch these giant weather balloons. They're as big as a house. To have those in the stratosphere, basically well above where airplanes fly, and they would be like beaming internet down to people's homes and businesses and in rural areas. And this was launched in 2014, actually before the Alphabet announcement. But the thing that happened, I think probably that's maybe more significant, is Google Glass, which was the sort of moonshot that predated this, which was the eyeglasses that you would wear. It was basically a huge flop. And I think that is part of what caused some of the retrenchment at Google. So Loon, for instance, it seems like they're going to be held to a higher standard, but the project is still alive. I think it wouldn't surprise me if, I guess later this year or early next year, we'll see some sort of announcement about a trial of the program. But I mean, the bigger story here is just that Google is focusing a little bit more closely on its core business, which is search and advertising, a little bit of YouTube, and then the rest of the stuff is being, you know, ever so slightly de-emphasized.
Right, right. They're giving space still to, I think, and it sounds like that's kind of from the start has long been a part of their culture, right? To bring space to create and innovate into the workday of employees. I think a lot of Google employees have talked about that kind of style of, you know, there's, I don't know what it is, 20% or one day a week or whatever it is, you know, where you're allowed to just kind of create and think and work on an independent project. And it seems like it would only make sense to apply that to the business model as well. And so what financial impact is that really happening? Do we see some solid numbers about that initial Google Glass launch? Because as you pointed out, that was a weird one. I think a lot of people were kind of curious enough to try it, but the practical application, I mean, I tried it and it was really awkward and you had to hold your head in a weird way that made people look up your nose. And it seemed kind of weird to use Google Glass.
So one thing that's happened as a result of this belt tightening, if you will, is a lot of people have left. A bunch of senior executives, the sort of more entrepreneurial types who were drawn to Google as this quirky place, who thought they could basically just, you know, do anything. A lot of them have been leaving, and that's on one hand, maybe that's troubling because, you know, it's never a good sign for a company, especially, you know, a company like Google to be losing people. On the other hand, I think there's an argument to be made that with something like Glass, they were hamstrung a little bit by the sheer amount of money and by the basically appetite that CEO Larry Page has for risk. So they're in a situation where they make so much money, they can basically afford to spend an unlimited amount of money researching something like Glass or like the driverless car. And, you know, as I think a lot of people who work in creative fields know, like, it's sometimes helpful to have constraints. And it's not always good to say you can spend as much money as you want and just get it right, because then you just sort of end up spending money endlessly on experiments and trying to get it perfect rather than taking a product to market and you know, seeing if it works. And I think with something like Glass, they probably sort of tested it out a little sooner before having this big consumer marketing splash where they had these headsets, you know, on people like you and me and also on models at Fashion Week. And they had a, you know, 12-page spread in Vogue. So I think that kind of created a situation where you had basically an experimental product that people were looking at as if it were a finished product. With the car, it's kind of a similar story where, you know, Google, I think by all accounts, Alphabet, by all accounts, has the best driverless car technology. On the other hand, they've been basically beat to market by two competitors, Tesla and Uber, which don't probably have quite as robust a technology, you know, sort of back end as Google does. On the other hand, they've been able to take something to market, get feedback from customers, and basically, you know, plant their flag in the space. And I think in general, it's sort of been hard for Google to innovate, in partly because they have so much money.
Right, right. And it's certainly, you know, that's just kind of a basic business principle, right? If you're going to throw a lot of money at something, it's going to be hard to call it a success. It almost sets it up to be a failure because you've spent so much money on it. To even break even, it has to be an astronomical success, you know, just to get there.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, there's like a classic phenomenon, like the innovator's dilemma, which says that it's hard for big companies companies to keep doing new things. I think Google thought they could kind of get around that. And I think what they've been finding is, you know, these the same rules that apply to everyone else that have applied to IBM and Microsoft, and, you know, this would make them shudder there in Mountain View, but they also apply to Alphabet and to Google.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much, Max Chafkin, for being with us. Everybody, head to Bloomberg.com and check out this story. It's a really interesting long read. Thanks very much, Max. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You know, my friends, before we go to break, I want to check in with our good friend, Ro Khan, who is out at Apple Chevrolet in Tinley Park. Hi, Ro. How are you doing?
Hello.
Hi. What's going on
today? Oh,
there
I am.
There
Hello.
You are. What's happening out in Tinley Park today?
Well, Apple Chevrolet, 8585 West 159th Street in Tinley Park, Amy, in case you're wondering. We are doing our Toys for Tots drive. It's the 19th year we've raised toys for Toys for Tots. It's going great so far. Hundreds of toys are in. We want to get to the thousands number right now. So people are stopping by if they've been out, especially down here in the southern suburbs, if they've been out shopping for their kids or family members or whatever. They pick up an extra toy or two or ten. And on average, people are coming in with like five and six toys a piece. It's really awesome.
Excellent. And so people just need to swing by and drop off toys, or do they need to wrap them or anything special they need to
know? No. Just, you know, brand new toys, not opened and not gift wrapped. So the Marines who are here are able to go through and, just, you know, they do a boy and girl pile when they take them back to their distribution center. And an important thing to note, Amy, very important thing to note is that all these toys stay in the Chicagoland area. This is not like a national or even international kind of thing. This is the Marine Corps reserve units service the communities from which they come, the reserve communities they come from. And so all of these toys are going to stay here in the Chicagoland area that are being raised today.
Excellent. Give us the address one more time, Ro.
8585 West 159th Street in Tinley Park, Apple Chevrolet.
All right, and you'll be there till 3 o'clock today.
Yeah, or later, whatever.
Sure.
I'm here until the last toy arrives.
Excellent. I love that. All right, well, we're going to check back in with you a little bit later. Thanks very much, Ro.
Thanks.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are talking about, speaking of toys, the Hatchimals. It is a thing. If you don't know about it, you soon will, because they're everywhere. All right, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us today. You know, every year it seems like there's that one it toy, you know, like back in the day it was the Cabbage Patch. At one point it was the Beanie Babies. Whatever, it's always something. Griffin, what are those things called? Remember, it was like a pocket pet. It was like a keychain pet. Was it the, gosh, it's
Gigapets, I think. Was that it?
Was that it? Where you had to like press a button to feed it, or it would die and give you sad eyes? It made you feel like a big jerk.
I had one, but it didn't hold my interest.
It didn't hold your interest.
No.
So, which is the nice way of saying you let your pet die, is what you're saying.
I let my little electronic toy.
You did. Way to be. Oh, and remember the
Is that the Tamagotchi?
Tamagotchi. Yeah. That's the word I was wanting. And then there was the strange little creature that was outlawed by the Pentagon. Do you remember that thing? Was that the Furby? I think that was the Furby.
I didn't know about its connections to the Pentagon.
Well, I remember specifically there was an announcement that you could not bring them into the Pentagon because they had, you know, they would learn from you and they would repeat things back to you and they would talk to you and interact. And so there was some degree of learning. And so I guess like a child brought one on a tour or something like that. And the Pentagon was like, nah, that's not a thing we can have. You can't have the Furby in the Pentagon. Or maybe they were just desk attire, you know. Government officials need something to snuggle, I suppose. Something like that.
Everyone does. They need it more than anyone.
Everyone does. But nonetheless, this year, the thing is called a Hatchimal. It is what it sounds like. It is like an egg, and then it hatches, and it's an animal. And people are, it is kind of like Cabbage Patch era again, right? Like people, there's some that are like $3,000 on eBay and Craigslist. People have them, and they are going to great lengths to try to resell them. And people are out offering things on Craigslist of like, hey, if you have a Hatchimal you're willing to sell, I will pay you this much for it. It's getting crazy. But of the stories of the Hatchimal finding, the most compelling, in my opinion, is author Sarah Gruen, who wrote Water for Elephants, very beautiful book. She bought about $23,000 worth of Hatchimals, about 156 of them. because she wanted to resell them for charity, and then she is unable to do so. So I guess there are some rules on eBay with how many. You can't just list 156 things.
If you're a new user.
Yeah. If you're established and you already, I think you have to have the 5 stars or whatever. You have to be an established seller. Then you can list more than a couple things at a time. But you certainly can't bust in there with 23 grand worth of Hatchimals and expect to sell them off. So that's why we need to always read the terms of service before we hatch internet plots. But nonetheless, she's kind of panicking because, as any of us would, she's out 23 grand on Hatchimals. And I have a feeling after Christmas, they're not going to fetch 23 grand, is my guess here.
Well, and she already bought them. The weird thing about this plan is that she already bought them at a markup. They're supposed to go for like $40 a piece, but I think she bought them for something like $80 or $100.
There's a story in New York Daily News. It says they generally retail around $59, and the average auction price is already about $151.
So already
going to be about $100 markup. That's just kind of the average there. So we don't know exactly what she bought it for, but
I don't think she bought it for retail price, though, is what I saw.
Right.
So she's already buying it at a markup, just expecting to sell it even higher. Ugh. It just stresses me out just thinking about it.
Can you imagine? Like, your heart's in the right place. You're like, I'm going to raise all this money for charity, and I'm going to buy these, and then I'm going to... It's an easy sell. Everybody wants these this year, so I'm just going to sell them off. So I will make an investment in these, and then that will help me donate all this money to charity. And then you are completely shot in the foot with that plan, and you're unable to unload them.
Yeah. And so she took to her Facebook and was hoping to get the word out there, and I don't know exactly what her next steps are. I mean, she's got a little time. Got a couple weeks before the day. We'll see.
She's getting some interesting and some unfortunate feedback on Facebook because she, as you point out, she has a big social media following. Some people do not really feel sorry for her. Some people are like, no, this is, perfectly honorable what you're doing. And I'm sure I have no doubt she will move them all along before Christmas because people are really gung-ho to find these Hatchimals. But somebody wrote something like, you rob hundreds of parents of the opportunity to give one of these to their children and now you want us to bail you out? No. Of course, there is no pleasing the internet.
No one should ever do anything and talk about it on the internet because you always get haters.
You don't always. Come on.
Well, no, not always, but frequently. You can't do anything. I mean, it just seems like I've been noticing that lately. I don't think it's
just
new.
Just lately?
Yeah.
Try being female on the internet
right,
Kester.
I know.
You can't even say,
well, I can't
I'm
that,
going to be on the radio today without something.
You what?
Right. So, Griffin and Kessler, let me propose this question to you. Was there ever a toy that you were so incredibly desperate to have one Christmas that you think perhaps Santa went to great lengths to get you?
I'm not the one to ask about that, I suppose, but not that I remember. All of my big Christmas wishes kind of came and went. I'm sure I was like in it in the moment, but I don't have the memory of really wanting something that bad. I don't know.
Kessler, what about you?
Every year.
But that continues.
Yeah, it's still now.
You're waiting for a Hatchimal now.
Not really a Hatchimal, no.
No. You know what? I always wanted like paints and books and like creative. So I always wanted like art supplies. I think one year I wanted like a bunch of fabric because I wanted to make a tent or something. Like I was always about make believe.
I know I wasn't asking for fabric, that's for sure. But I don't know.
I definitely asked for a treehouse one year. Like mine.
Oh yeah, sure.
Mine were either really effort intensive or pretty much like give the kids some paper and paint and off she goes.
So just one side of the spectrum or the other, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
I don't know. I think I would have wanted a Hatchimal, though.
I don't really understand that. I mean, I don't...
I think they hatch once. That's what I'm trying to wrap my head around. It's like it hatches and then you've got it.
And then
but
you have
that's
it.
Sort of the fun, right?
That's what... And this is like...
I don't know.
I don't have kids, so I'm probably missing a crucial step and there's a bunch of parents going, no, idiot, that's not how you do... You're missing the point, right? And that's perfectly fine. I admit that. I'm not around little children, so I don't really know the rub with Hatchimals, but it seems like I have seen... Every time I am online, I see either someone on Facebook talking about the lengths at which they're trying to go to obtain one.
Right.
might I suggest you go speak with Sarah Gruen, and or somebody saying they witnessed an interaction, like a meltdown. I saw somebody on Facebook saying at a Toys R Us here in town, or maybe it wasn't Toys R Us, but a toy store nonetheless, witnessed someone have a complete meltdown when the sales clerk said, "I'm sorry, we sold out of them." They were like holding this person personally responsible and screaming at them. Which is really unfair. Like, I'm just a holiday. I'm just like a seasonal retail employee. Can you please get off my case?
That's tough. I feel bad for everyone in that situation, including the Hatchimal-less child. You know, think of them too.
Someone think of the Hatchimal-less child.
At least the Hatchimals will have a safe and warm home for the holidays. There is a no Hatchimal will go unadopted this year.
Oh,
seems like
definitely not. Now think of the poor, like whatever last year's toy was, or the toy that came out that was really popular in the summer. That toy's like, what? What did we do?
The summer it was Pokemon, the app.
Oh
it was
yeah,
more of a virtual
everybody
thing.
Was.
But just think about that. How often do you see people doing that now? You don't see it.
And you know what was funny? The Pokemon game. There was a Pokemon outside of Tribune Tower, and so for a while, I think all of us on the air thought, oh my gosh, all of a sudden all these people are taking our pictures here in the studio. And we all were being ridiculous, thinking like, oh, that's so funny, all these people are taking pictures. No, they're taking pictures of the Pokemon that looks like it's sitting next to the studio. That's what was happening.
It's radio people thinking people were paying attention to us. How
I know.
What were we thinking?
Typical radio people. Anyway, well, we got to take a break, don't we there, Griffin? Let us do that. So we're going to take a break and then get you to news and all that good stuff. And back in just a bit on 720 WGN.